You're listening to Trek FM.
When Star Trek premiered in 1966, the idea of traveling through space on a ship like the Enterprise was truly futuristic. Today, that same idea is accepted by many to be the inevitable outcome of our technological advancement. I'm Christopher Jones, and this is Trek FM's Matter Stream. On Matter Stream, we look at the people and issues that have been influenced by Star Trek and the ideas that move us forward. After more than half a century of NASA exploration and 30 years of the Space Shuttle program, we've come to see space as the next step, an accessible domain that is just beyond our reach, but we're closing fast. Civilian projects such as Virgin Galactic reinforce this idea. But is it really possible? NASA's Ames Research Center and DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, has undertaken a project known as the 100-Year Starship Study, with an aim to make long-distance space travel practical and feasible. In this episode of Matter Stream, we're joined by Dr. Athena Andreadis, Associate Professor of Cell Biology at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Dr. Andreadis is the author of the book To Seek Out New Life, The Biology of Star Trek, and she spoke earlier this year at the 100-Year Starship Symposium. Hello, Athena. Thank you for joining me today. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Great. I'm.
Thank you, Chris. It's my pleasure.
Oh, yeah. It's great to be able to have you on. You know, we've known each other for a long time since you wrote your book about the biology of Star Trek years ago. And when this 100-year starship study came up and I found out that you were speaking at the symposium, I thought there was really no one better to come on and talk about this. And I'd love to find out more about what this study's really about and what you think about the long-term prospects and consequences of building a starship and going out into space might be. So, first off, can you give a little background about what this 100-year starship study is really about?
Certainly. The 100-year starship symposium was a DARPA-sponsored three-day conference that happened the last few days of September this year in Orlando. And essentially, it was a preliminary gathering to discuss the challenges facing a long-generation starship. So it ranged from things like propulsion systems to adapting to the journey itself, to adapting to planets other than Earth. So it covered the whole gamut of all these issues that people would have to address if they were going to tackle this type of task. So that's what it was.
It sounds like, well, one thing I was thinking is that, okay, as a Star Trek fan, when I hear about this, and I think most fans, we immediately picture the Starship Enterprise and Captain Kirk flying through the galaxy, you know, and so it was an exciting headline. It's like, wow, 100-year starship study, we're finally going to build a starship. But as you say right there, it sounds like maybe it's a little bit less about the actual construction of the starship and more about the scientific research in various areas to bring about maybe sometime in the future a starship. Is that pretty much?
Yes, in some respects, it's sort of a feasibility study. So they actually caution you, if you go to the site, which you will give us a link, you will find that they actually explicitly say this is not about building a starship, but it's about how feasible it's going to be to build a starship. And of course, the question of what the definition of a starship is really very loose when you think about it, because you're right. When people think of starship, they think most people will say something like the Enterprise or the equivalent, where it's a big self-enclosed place. It clearly has, you know, the atmosphere. There's no problems with the atmosphere or with food. You know, people have families. It's sort of a small universe. Or they think of the idealized version of an O'Neill space colony, except it has engines and a destination. It's going somewhere, so to a particular planet or a slew of planets that are Earth-like for the final planetfall. And frankly, all of these are still none of these is real in terms of existing technology. So in some respects, it's not a bad thing that they are thinking of feasibility studies, but it certainly puts a damper on things.
Yeah. We have to do these studies, and we're not that close to building a starship as maybe we sometimes think we are, just based on, you know, the 30 years of the space shuttle program, and we watch Star Trek all the time, and so we kind of feel like
right.
We're almost
Well,
there, right?
If you look at all of the missions, the crewed missions specifically, they were all short term. They were not aiming at self-sufficiency or sustainability. They basically were glorified jaunts. They were going somewhere for a few days and zip back. You know, the space station is dependent entirely on food and whatnot from Earth. It is not a self-enclosed ecosystem. So yes, we actually are very, very far behind on a lot of things that would be absolutely, I mean, they wouldn't even be necessary. It's like it wouldn't happen without having a lot of basics. And of course, when people talk about these, the first and sometimes the only thing that comes up are the propulsion systems. Well, you know, if we have to go somewhere, we have to do better than chemical rockets because chemical rockets are inefficient and you need a lot of fuel and they're slow, blah. But the thing is, you know, that's like saying, well, you know, let's have the first few opening bars to an opera. It's actually the tiniest thing in terms of what else you have to consider. And that's why they had to their credit, the 100-year starship organizers had invited, you know, historians, biologists, ethicists, anthropologists, and so forth. But they negated a lot of this interdisciplinary fertilization by actually having like six or seven simultaneous tracks. So that basically meant, you know, the engineers went to the propulsion talks and the historians went to the ethics talks, and there was no crosstalk. So you didn't leave any much wiser than you came in, because what you knew, you already knew, and the rest you did not have time to attend because it was so tightly scheduled.
Yeah, absolutely. You need these disciplines to intermingle more, right? And if you're going to do this for the long term. This just makes me think of one question here. Now, when we talk about the name 100-Year Starship Study, is it intended to, and how do you see it? Is it a 100-year study? Is it a study to possibly within 100 years build a starship, or is it a study of, if we send out a starship and the crew, we're going to take, say, 100 years to reach a destination, so it's a multi-generational type ship? What is the meaning of
right.
the name?
I think, no, specifically they want to be like that the next 100 years will be the time to study this. I do not think you can realistically say we're going to send a crewed starship that will take 100 years to reach a destination. For one thing, as you probably read the latest Kepler 22, et cetera, or the Gliese 581 last year. The problem is that we still don't have destination planets. We really don't. I mean, all of these places are largely conjectured to be Earth-like, based on very, very flimsy evidence at this point. Now, mind you, confirmations that require heroic effort. I mean, and even if you quote-unquote confirm that it's Earth-like in that, well, it's rocky, it's within the habitable zone of a G-type star, it has a thick atmosphere, it has temperature that allows liquid water, etc., you know, the devil's in the detail. There are so many, many other things that could make it or not make it habitable to someone like us. Of course, with the added caveat that if it was habitable to someone like us, it probably has its own native life, which actually poses a humongous dilemma.
Yeah. You travel all the way there, and then you land, and there's some kind of carnivorous life form there, right, that just eats the colonists as soon as they land.
maybe not. It's because we don't have a second life sample, we still don't know what's universal, what's parochial for life. So if you have life that's significantly different from us, it probably will not interact with us in any meaningful way. Nevertheless, we still will need the resources of that planet, which means that even if not directly, we will be competing with native life in terms of habitats, in terms of resources, whatever. So it's not an easy thing overall. It's sort of problematic because if it's one thing to pretend that you're the Federation and you have the Prime Directive or the equivalent and all this hunky-dory and everybody's wearing white hats. But in reality, that's not how it's going to be, especially when people arrive and the starship may well be running out of resources or drowning in its own wastes, and they really cannot go back. You know, it's a lot of, in fact, there are going to be one-way trips, all of these, frankly.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, you pretty much any of these, you're not going to be able to go back anywhere, right? You're there,
right.
And you're going to have to deal with the situation. Which is, yeah, again, one of the big problems. Now, was that something that was addressed at the symposium?
It was one of the several things that were addressed, including what the likely destinations are, what to do if you go there, and you can imagine there was a range of opinions, and it also won't surprise you to know. To find out that, you know, the engineers were much more gung-ho than the anthropologists, for example, because the anthropologists have seen similar scenarios play out on Earth, and it's not a happy ending. If you've read the Mann's book 1491, you know, and you know that, for example, 90%+ of the Native American population died even before any conquistadors or manifest destiny maniacs showed up, things like that. I mean, you know, you could see it happening, and in some ways you cannot even prevent it. Just by going there, you could start this kind of thing. And of course, the more triumphalist designs of terraforming and whatnot, these are really fantasy. They're not even science fiction, frankly. Mm-hmm. They're fantasy. Because a starship is not going to have that kind of capabilities. Okay, if you really want to terraform, to really terraform a planet, the strongest determinants are things like distance from primary and eccentricity of orbit. You're not going to be able to change that. Period. It's not going to happen. So yes, I mean but DARPA insisted basically on having a very wide umbrella. So basically, everybody, no matter how crazy they sound, you know, can come and say what they feel is important about this topic. And so, you know, it was a large meeting actually because of all these tracks, 7 tracks per day, going on pretty much from like 9 to 5 for about 2.5 days. So yeah, there was a lot of stuff.
I believe that you said in a piece that you wrote after this, that there were quite a few, I want to say 7, maybe science fiction writers that were also at the symposium.
Towards the end, there were 2 panels, there were 10, 2 times 5. So one panel, each of 5 people. Yes. The first panel was mostly older science fiction writers who most of them were like physicists, engineers, whatever. The second panel had some of these, and they had 2 people who were more towards AI, like Vinge and Strauss. But interestingly enough, there was not a single participant that came from anthropology, biology, history, not one. And of course, all of them were men but one, which also colors the whole shall we say, approach.
Yeah. What were the science fiction writers' contribution to the symposium?
I think they just wanted to make it cool to some extent. I mean, I sort of attended part of one. I did not attend the other. So I am not the best person to tell you because I did not hear them. One other thing, by the by, is that they originally said they would publish all of these things as an abstract booklet and or publish the talks or the abstracts in the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, but then they backed off from that. And apparently now you cannot get hold of any of this. And by the by, they wouldn't even make the recordings available. although they recorded the talks, but they said that was for internal consumption only, whatever that means. And so that means that basically you cannot really access any of this unless you ask individual authors for their abstracts or talks or presentations.
Huh, interesting. So it's all been classified, basically. That's what
you,
it sounds
you
like.
You could say that.
Yeah, which leads me to another question that I had for you, which is that the 100-Year Starship Study is a joint undertaking of NASA, Ames Research Center, and DARPA, which is part of the Department of Defense,
right.
The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So we know from the history of space exploration that the military typically, you know, as it goes with most things, it's like if it has a military application, then it gets resources and it gets attention, and otherwise it maybe doesn't. How much is this tied into the military, or do you know what extent?
I will tell you what I think, and you know the impression I formed. It sounds like basically DARPA, you know, was involved in the space exploration program. However, I think they were told basically to not be involved anymore, that this was not something that the self-respecting defense agency does. So they were left with this itsy-bitsy to others, but to them, a small pot of $1 million that was still earmarked space exploration. So what they did is they spent about half of it on organizing the symposium, and the other half that was left, they basically sent out a request for applications, and it's going to be a one-time, one-shot grant. The idea being that the grant will be given to somebody who will sort of be handed this project, the task of the question of a starship, and that somebody will be a civilian group, maybe a private contractor, whoever. And so this happened in November, was when this grant was due, and a fair number of places responded, and in about 3 to 6 months, this grant will be awarded, and DARPA then can go to Congress and say, we're not in this business anymore, we are not involved. So that's the answer to that question. So the answer is DARPA doesn't want to be involved anymore. They were basically told not to.
So basically, this is not really a military project.
No.
At this point, which I don't know if that's good or bad. In a way, if it were, it would get a lot more financing and a lot more drive.
Right. I agree. I mean, for private, you and I have talked a little bit about this. You know, private enterprise is not the way to finance this. This will get off the ground if there's a central authority that has consistent, sustainable funding stream, period. I mean, NASA is also limping at this point, limping rather badly. And although their robot missions have been spectacular successes, I mean, really spectacular, and they've really given us tremendous amount of knowledge and information, the crewed part of things has really lagged and wilted. For all kinds of reasons, some having to do with them, some having to do with the overall social and political climate.
Right, because as the resources become thinner, as we've seen over the past few years, I guess anything that's purely for scientific knowledge is kind of going to the back burner a bit.
Well, I think people don't seem to realize something fairly fundamental, and that is that what they consider applied science is basically comes after basic science. So people already are complaining that, oh my God, there are not enough new drugs for diseases, and there are not enough, you know, what's going on with cancer, or diabetes, why aren't we progressing, or dementia, whatever. And the answer is, how do you think you're going to progress if you don't give money for basic research? Who do you think is going to do this? Pharma is in it for profit. They're not going to develop something that's completely brand new, because they will take some risk, but the risk is more towards incremental changes. You know, the real changes will come from basic science, but it will take a generation or two for this to sort of become crystal clear. And by then, you know, they will have to start de novo because they will have basically lost several generations of scientists.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like sometimes as a society we've come to think that there's like a replicator, right? That anything we want can just magically appear without there being any work behind it
Right.
or the research to get there. Do you think that this kind of apathy towards real research and development that seems to pervade the society these days, I would assume that this would have a very significant impact over whether or not we're ever actually able to realize, you know, the visions of space exploration or even building the starship like this study here. Is
Oh,
that...
yes. You know, what's interesting about this, and it actually goes back to what we just discussed about, you know, solve the problems of Earth first. What's interesting is that, in fact, what would make a starship feasible and sustainable would be the same things that would make Earth better. For example, you know, environmental activism, you know, if you want the environment to be maintained at some level of integrity, it's the same in a ship. You have to be able to maintain an internal ecosystem if you want to have it reach its destination without people blowing holes in the hull. You have to figure out a way of getting a working society and so forth. So in some ways, the problems of Earth and the problems that would make or break a starship are very much the same. And if you work on one, you're working on the other. So people who say, oh, it's one or the other, actually seem to be missing the point in some ways.
Another question here, just this leads me to the next idea here. We talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but when we do, if we do eventually build a starship, and if we have destination planets at that point in time, they're obviously going to be very far away. And we don't have to get into physics here of whether or not we'll ever be able to travel at the speed of light like they do in Star Trek, but assuming that it's probably will take a great deal of time to reach any destination planet, we would have to have multi-generational ships. And from a societal and maybe also from a biological, you know, standpoint, does that seem like something that could ever be feasible to you?
You know, I do not know. In all, nobody does. Nobody really, really knows how feasible it is. You know, humanity started from a very small founder population. If you look back and you do things like mitochondrial DNA analysis or even analysis of variants, you find out that we passed through a bottleneck of about 150 people, which is actually 10 times less than what is required for so-called hybrid vigor. The idea being, you know, not too much inbreeding, because a lot of lethal recessives would eventually surface. So what has happened on Earth now is because somehow Homo sapiens sapiens essentially is the only humanoid present, hominin, whichever way you want to call them. We no longer, and because we can now travel, we have there are no isolated founder populations. So we really don't know what the next step would be, if any, or if people got re-isolated. If we ever send starships, essentially we're going to recreate the founder effect. Each starship is going to be a founder population. But whether we can, let's assume that we do have a starship with a working self-enclosed ecosystem, that we have taken care of radiation problems, we have taken care of any and all of the above, that we have a fairly benign, functional, governing, way to govern and regulate the society. You know, when you look on Earth, you know, civilizations sort of kind of last. But, you know, not necessarily for thousands of years. In fact, you know, the longest civilizations, if you look at them, they're maybe 2,000-3,000 years old. And you know, it's a question to ask. And biologically, we're just one species, you know. And what will happen, I think, is when we go on this long, if, as you say, we go, And if we manage to sustain these journeys and make planetfall, each of these starships will actually be the starting point of a somewhat new species, because they will diverge, and eventually, of course, once you go to a planet that's different from Earth, and they all will be by definition, no matter how Earth-like they are, they will go very fast. They will start speciating, and eventually will become cousins rather than siblings.
And what do, theoretically, what shape do you think that might take? What are some of the possible evolutionary directions that offshoots of the human race that do colonize another world might take?
Well, it could be anywhere from people who are, for example, more resistant to heavy metals if you go to a world that is more metal rich than we are. You might end up having people that might be able to hibernate if you go in a world that has extreme climate, temperature differentials. Then you could have real, but all of this it takes time to make these changes. And of course, if between you and me, if a starship loses technology significantly and makes planetfall without any technological resources, I think the most likely outcome is they're going to die. They're just going to die. It's like that Russell, very depressing novel called We Were About To. That's what happens. Basically, they crash land on a planet. It's kind of like Earth, enough for them to breathe and find food, but that eventually they die. Then, of course, you have more interesting science fiction novels like Kingsbury's Courtship, right, where they manage to survive, but they have technology and they use it. They have to. They have no choice.
So no matter what, it is going to be a difficult journey.
Oh, yes, definitely.
In some ways, it's a way for the human race to survive if someone succeeds. But in another way, it's not, because those people may no longer be human.
There is that, but also when you also look at humans as well, you will notice that although the trips were not necessarily heroic migrations, 90% of humans stayed where they were, and then a 10% did the next step, reached the new place, and then the population grew, and 10% of that or so or less went to the next stage. And also when they moved, they sort of moved in small increments. You know, they moved to the next valley. They moved downstream. The only exceptions, of course, and in fact, this is what the Starship launch would look like, are the Polynesian migration. I mean, they went on their catamarans with, you know, pigs and yams and everybody on the raft, and they did it by dead reckoning. They had no compasses. And by signs, you know, by the clouds in the horizon, by birds congregating, by looking at the currents and looking at the stars. And we don't know, the Polynesians of today are the descendants of those who made landfall, and we don't know how many didn't. And in fact, I suspect most didn't, and a few who did.
Yeah, you would have to suspect that most didn't in that situation, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, but in this case, we would be going to the next valley. We would be going, you know, the next 20 light years, 40 light years, 100 light years away. So the valleys are very far away.
They are. And the other thing, too, is that the valleys here, I mean, you still can breathe and eat and so forth. Whereas, you know, a starship, if something goes wrong, you cannot, the leeway is much, much, much smaller. So yes, the analogy is not exact, but that's the closest that you will get.
Right.
And that the other thing, of course, is that now the first world has become averse to loss. It's like, you know, we cannot do this unless we're certain that this will work. And it's like, as a matter of fact, I can guarantee you that a lot of these won't work, and the losses will be heavy. So if you, it's like, you know, all of these launches, you know, think of Columbus, okay? How many went and how many came back? And they were actually at the top of their technology at the time, those ships.
And think if they had said, well, we're only going to do this if we can guarantee that not a single person on this crew will die during the journey, then it would have never happened. The
Never.
whole world would be entirely different now.
Right. And perhaps actually more interesting in some ways, but yes.
Right. Oh, well, while we're talking about life out there, another thing I wanted to ask you, which of course would be of great interest to Star Trek fans. Now, you wrote a book called To Seek Out New Life, The Biology of Star Trek, and you talked a lot about how life could evolve in other places and maybe a more realistic view of life compared to what we see in Star Trek, where everyone, has a different bump on their head or they're
Right,
pretty much
right.
all humanoid, which of course kind of gets explained in the Next Generation episode, The Chase, where we find out that there are, some single race seeded all the planets in the galaxy. But
Well, look, so except they messed up the genetics, but be that as it may.
right. Well, that we kind of expected that, right, to
Right.
happen in Star Trek, but
They're far, far be it from them to hire a grad student for the science, but yes.
yeah. Well, at least these things got a little bit better scientifically compared to, say, the science fiction of the 60s, where
Yes,
I think they
agreed.
were just completely making up everything, right? But in reality, I mean, what are the chances, just given your knowledge of how life evolves, and what are the chances that we may ever, if we venture out in the stars and we succeed in all what we've talked about here, colonizing other worlds, and are able to explore the galaxy, what are the chances that we would ever meet another civilization, much less one that's technologically on par with ours, which, most of the civilizations in Star Trek seem to be within about 100, 200 years of each other, or maybe not even that much technologically in development. What's the likelihood of any of this ever being a reality
In
in the
reality,
galaxy?
I would say that the possibility of meeting relatively, people could call it complex life, but in fact, even bacterium is very complex. So the possibility of finding life that is at the stage of bacterial or so forth is actually, I would say, and other people will disagree, it's fairly high. Because there's a lot of stars that have planetary entourages, a lot of places that seem to have all of the conditions necessary. Finding a place with life that has reached the stage of saying taking let's say the Jurassic equivalent, probably less so. The thing with civilizations again is that. Even if we receive a signal, the signal is going to be from the distant past. It's unclear, for example, if that civilization still exists, or if the people who developed it have not gone on to some other stage, whatever that may be, for better or for worse. So I'd say that the chances of meeting a civilization on par with ours within 100 light years is probably zero. But the finding different types of life, and most of it, in fact, de facto, will be very different from ours. And it's not going to be hominids with bumps that can eventually mate with us and produce, kids with other medium-sized bumps. It's not going to be the case. So, but there will be probably other life. And in fact, it could well be that Europa and Titan have life. But not the life that wants to shake your hand or discuss philosophy with you. At the same time, I think that there may be, or there may have been, or there might be in the future civilizations within the galaxy, but it's just that the distances are so vast that essentially it's like ships passing in the night. We may get their signals, they may get ours. But a face-to-face meeting is probably very unlikely. So that's my sense of things.
Yeah, that seems to be the reality if you actually, follow
Yes, but
science
you
as far as
cannot
the
do space.
exploration
Look,
between.
if you want to have high drama, as in space opera, you have to have exotic propulsion systems that shrink the distances. So it has to be faster than light, it has to be warp drive, it has to be stable wormholes. any and all of the above. Otherwise, there cannot be no drama. There can be no fighting for territory or fighting for power.
Star Trek would not be very interesting if every episode was them sitting in San Francisco at Starfleet headquarters searching for signals, and then once every season they detect a signal.
Right.
And that's the high point of every season.
Right.
And people will be fans will be like, I really liked season 4 when they detected that one signal. That was the best
that
season.
Was very dramatic.
You know, they were able to talk about that one for 3 episodes before they were
out of
luck again.
You can see it happening with all of these planets. It's like people are like, oh my God, second Earth. Oh, not second Earth. You know, I mean, they want new candy. You know, the discovery was extremely important and interesting, but you can see people saying, well, if it does, if no little green people, not interested. You know, people go for the dramatic.
For sure. Well, this was very interesting to talk about the starship study here, and especially because you're able to bring that angle here of what it really means for humanity, for life, and the reality of exploration. It's exciting to think about building a starship, but I don't know if 100 years from now, if it's even possible. And certainly, I don't think the Enterprise is 100 years away, right? We're talking maybe like Zefram Cochrane's little Phoenix ship or something, except without the light speed factor, right?
Yes, I think so. Right now, it seems as though every vehicle that comes around certainly would not be the Enterprise size. And in a way, it's not surprising that they would start small, so to speak, but at the same time, you can see that a lot of what's going on is not, you know, part of me feels almost nostalgic for the fact that when I was a youngster, this was considered something that would happen. And now it's unclear if it will happen because, you know, a lot of windows are closing. And if we sort of give up on this, it's unclear if you can jumpstart it again, you know? And
yeah,
it's sad.
I feel the same way. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It does feel like we're missing, like time is running out on an opportunity that we grew up seeing as our future.
Well, in particular, you know, we were lucky in being both able of having the resources and actually having the technology to harness them. So when things start becoming scarce, then a lot of these things will fall by the wayside. It's only now normal that they would. So if the other thing is that we have sort of harvested everything that's easy to harvest, you know, metals, ores that are close to the surface, oil that it's easy to extract, and so forth. So if we lose technology now, we might not be able to recover it soon because a lot of the things that we depend on are no longer easily available the way they were when we started.
Yeah, exactly. We have to hope that the ship can be turned, but we'll have to see where it goes because it doesn't always look positive right now, but we can always keep hoping as science fiction is so good at doing. So, Athena, in closing here, why don't we talk just a little bit more about some of your other writing? Because I certainly, based on our discussion here, I think that listeners will want to read more of your views on these things, as well as, you know, you write fiction as well. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the other things that you do outside of this type of research?
Well, I maintain a site which is its name is Starship Reckless, and I have a blog there which discusses science fiction, space exploration, art, and I have indeed published fiction, both prose and poetry. And there are links there if anyone wishes to visit, and they will find those. And other than that, you know, the book itself has a site of its own, The Biology of Star Trek, and that has, you know, a few of the basics there. But right now, most of my activities at my website, the Starship Reckless one, and I, of course, continue to do my research. So if anybody visits the UMass Medical website and looks for my name, you know, they will find me in the faculty website, and they will find a description of what I do for research, which is basically delving into molecular mechanisms of brain functions.
Right. What is your current research about?
It centers on the products of on two genes. One basically keeps your neurons happy, and if something goes wrong with its regulation, you get early onset dementia, frontotemporal dementia. So I'm looking at something called it's alternative splicing, and it's actually a way of generating many products from a single gene. Most human genes undergo this process, and if it goes awry, you get all kinds of really nasty stuff happening, anywhere from spinal degeneration to dementia and everything in between. So that's one of the things that I do. The other one is this itsy-bitsy little gene that only exists in humans and their closest primate relatives. But humans have a unique variant that does not exist in their cousins. And this little guy seems to, the human-specific variant, seems to confer susceptibility to dementia. So something interesting is going on with this, in that here we are, we have this expanded frontal cortex, which is unique. That's why we have protruding foreheads, in fact. And this is where a lot of our executive functions lie. But this is also the part that is uniquely susceptible to the ravages of dementia, and especially as we have become longer and longer lived. So it's both a blessing and a curse, and of course it has caused all our wars and so forth and so on. But that's what I do during the day.
I see. So it's caused all of our wars, although the end result of your research may not be to end war, but it may be to help to address the problems of dementia and mental disease.
I hope so. I mean, but what's interesting, what it does tell you, among other things, is, as you probably know, there's a lot of simplified systems, like people often use mice to approximate human conditions. But actually, you can do all kinds of neat things, like you can easily both cause and cure cancer in mice. That's not true for humans. So again, biology is really the science of detail. Details are as important as the big things. So a lot of the things that make us or break us as humans are specific to us, and they cannot easily be recapitulated or mimicked in other systems, which actually brings a dilemma, in that you often can only use sort of like, you can use human cell lines, of course, and so forth. But in the end, you know, sometimes you, for therapies, pass to the question of, well, does something, is something toxic, period, you may have to try it directly on humans. On the other hand, of course, humans are the only life form on Earth that's capable of informed consent. So there is that. Again, not an easy thing altogether.
No, none of this stuff is easy, right?
No, so, it isn't.
That's fascinating work, and also your writing. I really encourage everyone to go read that as well in your blog. So we'll put links in the show notes to your blog, to Seek Out New Life, the Star Trek biology book, and of course to where people can find out more about your research as well.
That will be lovely.
All right. Well, Athena, thanks so much for joining me today. It's been a fascinating discussion.
It was a great pleasure, Chris. Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it very much.
That was Dr. Athena Andreadis, Associate Professor of Cell Biology at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. If you'd like to learn more about the 100-year Starship study, you can find the website at 100yss.org. And you can also find Dr. Andreadis at starshipreckless.com, to seekoutnewlife.com, and at umassmed.edu/shriver/faculty. And we'll have links to these in the show notes for this episode on our website at trek.fm/ms. If you're looking for more Star Trek discussion, be sure to check out our other long-form show, The Ready Room, where we discuss Star Trek news, episodes, characters, and just basically geek out every Tuesday. You'll find this, along with all sorts of other Star Trek shows, games, and features, on our website at trek.fm. and you can also get the enhanced versions of our podcasts in iTunes. And that's it for our show this week. A huge thanks to Dr. Andreidis for taking the time to talk with us. I really hope you all enjoyed it. For Trek FM, I'm Christopher Jones. I'll see you next time for another dip into the matter stream.